Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1362. What really happened at Pearl Harbor, part one. This is being recorded on December 7th of the year 2024. Before we get into the main body of the program, please get a hold of the now 64 gigabyte flash drive that contains all of my life's work, including the many programs that are conversations with Monty. It contains also everything that is printed, including the remarkable contributions of Tara Fractal, our contributing editor, and also a mini library of old anti-fascist books available on easy-to-download PDF files. I get no money whatsoever from this. And I think that as sentient beings, and they'll sound corny as hell maybe, but as sentient beings, we have a responsibility to preserve the record of what happened for the future. Now, today is December 7th. That is obviously the anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor, December 7th, 1941. And there may be people in the audience going, well, there goes Dave Emery again, talking about all that old stuff with regard to World War II. Who cares, you know, like, wow, dude. It actually is very, very relevant. I'm hearing so much BS about Pearl Harbor, and in particular, the disinformation. It's not misinformation. It is not error, although many people have parodied it, but the disinformation that Franklin Roosevelt deliberately allowed the attack on Pearl Harbor to take place is being used to discredit the New Deal. And in particular, as I speak on December 7th of 2024, with Donald Trump getting ready to take the oath of office for the second time, with the Republicans controlling both the Senate and the House of Representatives, and with Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, the Republican Speaker of the House, saying that they needed to cut Social Security and Medicare to pay for, drumroll fanfare, increases in the defense budget, which is just wild. One of the things that is being used to justify the general tossing the defenestration of the New Deal is the notion that Franklin Roosevelt was a traitor to the U.S. and that he deliberately allowed the attack on Pearl Harbor to take place. That is not true. And it is very, very relevant today. It also has taken its place in the evolution of the Republican Party. We're going to talk about Thomas Dewey, who ran for president on the Republican ticket both in 1944 when he was defeated by Franklin Roosevelt and in 1948 when he was narrowly defeated by Harry Truman, and his campaign manager and, quote, whose official title was speechwriter, unquote, was Alan Dulles. And this is all very relevant to this day. Now, as I get into the subject material of the two programs, and there's going to be at least two shows doing this, I hope not more than that, but at times I'm going to unpack for the audience some of my knowledge of the dynamics of the order of battle, or ORBAT, in particular the battleships and the carriers. One of the things that has been bruited about by the ignorant is that Franklin Roosevelt deliberately allowed the battleships to get sunk and that the carriers were all out of port because this represented part of the whole conspiracy, blah, 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 blah. It simply is not true. Later on in the program, I will talk about that. To make a very, very, very long story, very, very short, the battleships and the aircraft carriers fell on different sides of the Washington Naval Treaty of 1922. The battleships have a top speed of maybe 22, 23 knots. By the way, just off the top of my head, the battleships were the USS California, the USS Arizona, the USS Nevada, the USS Oklahoma, the USS West Virginia, the USS Tennessee, the USS Maryland, and the flagship at that point in time of the Seventh Fleet, which was the USS Pennsylvania. Those battleships have a top speed of about maybe 22-23 knots a mile per hour. The carriers, two of them had top speeds of roughly 35 knots per hour. Two of the carriers in the Pacific, actually the Saratoga and the Lexington, were converted battle cruisers. More about that later. The carriers would have been slowed down enormously had they been sortied with the battleships. Plus, the battleships were very poorly armed against anti-air, from the standpoint of anti-aircraft. They had a roughly, I think it was 3-inch, 50-caliber anti-aircraft main battery. Put a question mark by it. It may have been 3.5 inches, I'm not sure. But they were old weapons. They did not have the range or the destructive power of the 5-inch guns on the 10 fast battleships, again from memory. The two of the North Carolina class, the USS North Carolina and her sister ship, the USS Washington, then the four ships of the South Dakota class, the South Dakota, the Indiana, the Massachusetts, and the Alabama, the latter of which, by the way, Bob Feller, the Hall of Fame pitcher for the Cleveland Indians, served as a gunner in one of the quad 40-millimeter mounts. And then the four fast battleships of the Iowa class, the USS Iowa, BB-61, the USS New Jersey, BB-62, the most famous of the ships, the USS Missouri, BB-63, and the USS Wisconsin, the BB-64. Again, those ships had 5-inch guns as their heaviest anti-aircraft weapon. They have a much greater range, much more destructive power, and when they were firing ammunition with proximity fuses that were developed during the war, where the rounds fired would detect the metal on aircraft that would explode in the air without having to hit them, and that made the weaponry that much more devastating. But the battleships were poorly, the old battleships were very poorly equipped to fight from an anti-aircraft standpoint. They had an old primary heavy anti-aircraft weapon that you had to fuse three shells, fuse, 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 and then bang, fuse, bang, fuse, bang, fuse. They had a very low rate of fire. They did not have good range. They weren't as destructive. And eventually, all of the battleships except for the USS Arizona, more about that later, and the USS Oklahoma, which was eventually raised, but it never saw combat. But the other battleships were raised and re-equipped with 5-inch guns, and the USS West Virginia, which was sunk at Pearl Harbor, was anchored right next to the USS Missouri, very close to the USS Missouri, when it was used to sign the surrender of Japan in Tokyo Bay in early September of 1945. Had the battleships been sortied with the aircraft carriers, it would have slowed them down, and the battleships would have been sunk in deep water, and they would not have been raised and sent back into service. Again, from memory, the last clash of dreadnoughts in the open sea was the Battle of Surigao Strait during the brutal naval battles of the Philippine Islands in 1944, and many of the battleships involved with that battle had actually been battleships that were sunk or badly damaged at Pearl Harbor. And they formed a gauntlet with not only cruisers, but destroyers and PT boats. And they sank a couple of the old Japanese battleships at that battle. But again, had they been sortied with the carriers, they would have been sunk in deep water. They would have slowed the carriers down, theoretically, and very possibly gotten them sunk. But again, this is all fantasy, because it has nothing to do with physical reality. Now, for most, and again, I'm operating from memory here, but again, people who make many of the charges about, well, gee, the carriers they were out of the harbor, and this and the other thing, they don't know what the bleep they're talking about. And that is by design. Many of them are fundamentally ignorant, so they're simply parroting disinformation, not misinformation, but disinformation that they have learned. And I don't know if we could say that's their fault. It is not. But anyway, it is BS. Now, for most of the program, we are going to be relying on a very important book called Pearl Harbor, Final Judgment. This was co-authored by Henry C., as in Charlie Clausen, C-L-A-U-S-E-N, and Bruce Lee, who was an author having nothing to do with the martial artist and the late martial artist and movie star. Now, Henry Clausen, major and later colonel, I believe he was promoted. But he was PABbed by then Secretary of War Henry Stimson. By the way, what we now call the Defense Department was called the War Department or Department of War. Its secretary was Henry Stimson. By the way, his top aide was John J. McCloy, who had access to the magic intercepts. More about that later. But Henry Stimson PABbed Henry Clausen to look into what really happened at Pearl Harbor, and he had access to some very important documents, which he has very heroically, in my opinion, put into this book, and we are going to rely on this book and on the material from Henry Clausen. More about that later. But again, this book was published in hardcover by Leo Cooper, that's a British publisher, and the ISBN number, it, by the way, in 1990, it's copyright by Henry Clausen and Bruce Lee, 1992 and 1993. The ISBN number is 0850523907. Now, in the foreword, we're going to talk more about Henry Clausen later in the program. But in the foreword, Henry Clausen talks about some of the conspiracy theories, including the notion that Franklin Roosevelt deliberately allowed the attack to take place, which is not true. Before I read this, by the way, I should also mention a key dynamic of World War II in the Pacific. The U.S. not only helped to finance Japan's, the buildup of the Japanese zaibatsu and also their military, but they also sent not only scrap metal, but most importantly, oil. Much of the Japanese offensives in the Pacific, including a particular war against China, used in large measure oil that was shipped by the U.S., eventually bowing to pressure largely from the congressional faction, a large and decisive one that was allied with Great Britain. Franklin Roosevelt cut off the oil that was being shipped to Japan. Now, this forced the Japanese to look for an alternative source of oil. And again, this was because the British primarily and others, but mostly the British and also the Dutch to a lesser extent, feared that their colonies in the Pacific, correctly, by the way, might come under attack by the Japanese. But when Franklin Roosevelt cut off the flow of oil to Japan, which, again, raised the hackles of a lot of people who were pro-fascist and also some of the major financiers of the Japanese, and we've spoken about that in past programs, a wonderful book called The Yamato Dynasty by Sperling Seagrave and Peggy Seagrave goes into that in some detail. But the Japanese at that point in time, when Franklin Roosevelt cut off the oil, they were obliged to launch what was known as the Strike South. The attack on Pearl Harbor was meant to destroy the American fleet, freeing up the Japanese to successfully invade not only the Philippines, but more importantly, Indonesia, which was a Dutch colony and had a tremendous amount of oil. This gave them, and the Japanese were successful in invading and conquering Indonesia, this gave them an alternative source of oil, the Indonesian oil fields. But that is an important piece an important backstory to the entire thing. Now, Henry Clausen, in the foreword to this book, talks about many of the conspiracy theories and their the media voices and the individuals who are kicking those around. And to this day, as the Republicans are looking to cut Social Security and Medicare. Get absolutely infuriating. Every man and woman who has drawn a paycheck in this country has had a portion of their paycheck. If you're working for the usual employer, a portion of their paycheck has gone to their Social Security and Medicare. Now the Republicans want to cut that back to build up the defense budget. So one of the things that has generally been, and Social Security was implemented by Franklin Delano Roosevelt. We also notice that people in the military are not working to cut the another aspect of the New Deal, which is providing free medical care to people who have served in the armed forces, and also many of the benefits they get with regard to housing, education, and so forth. That is off the table, at least for the time being. But yet the Republicans are hell-bent for leather to cut Social Security, which was implemented by Franklin Roosevelt, and Medicare, which, although it actually passed under Lyndon Baines Johnson, was the brainchild and the legislative child of President John F. Kennedy. Now, in the foreword to this book, Henry Clausen writes, "Foreword: Why I wrote this book," and he writes as follows. What caused the disaster of Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941 has been one of the most contentious debates in American history, as well it should. More than half a century after the surprise Japanese attack, historians are still making charges that include a number of conspiracy theories that are wildly inaccurate. They contain the following concepts. A. President Franklin D. Roosevelt knew the attack was coming, but refrained from warning his Army and Navy commanders in Hawaii. B. Prime Minister Winston Churchill so badly wanted America to join England in fighting Hitler that he conspired to keep warnings that the Japanese were going to attack Pearl Harbor from President Roosevelt. C. The Soviet Union knew that the Japanese fleet was on its way to attack Pearl Harbor, but kept the information to itself because Russia, too, wanted America to join the war. Adding fuel to the fire from the American point of view, the commanders of our Army and Naval Forces of Hawaii claimed during the many investigations that followed in the wake of the disaster that Washington had withheld from them vital information that prevented them from being alert against a surprise attack. That is an absolute lie, as we will see. In its turn, continuing with Henry Clausen's foreword, in its turn, the Army Pearl Harbor Board, more about that later, went so far as to charge that the Army's Chief of Staff, General George C. Marshall, M-A-R-S-H-A-L-L, had failed to adequately warn his Hawaii command about Japanese intentions. But Secretary of State Cordell Hull had forced the Japanese to make their attack by virtue of the impossible conditions he had set during last-minute negotiations with Tokyo, and that as a result, President Roosevelt was also responsible for the attack, since Hull was carrying out the president's policies. Now, I know from my own experiences, I will explain later, but these conspiracy theories are untrue, as are the charges made by the Army Pearl Harbor Board. One merely has to employ common sense and remember that Roosevelt was a Navy man through and through. By the way, he had been Secretary of the Navy at one point during World War I. Continuing, he loved his ships. He loved the men who sailed them. Never, never would he allow his battleships to be sunk and his sailors drowned. Nor would the admirals and generals who advised Roosevelt allow a conspiracy that would destroy so much of our naval strength at a time when the nation needed it so badly. Common sense, however, has no authority when books and television shows can make money by promoting conspiracy theories. But I was totally shocked by the outpouring of misinformation that surrounded the 50th anniversary of Pearl Harbor. I would say it wasn't misinformation, it wasn't an error, although many people were parroting what they had been told. It was disinformation. It was an institutionalized set of lies, as we will see. Continuing. It began for me with a letter published in the New York Times on September 24, 1991, which said in part, "The body of evidence proves that the United States had broken the Japanese code, knew of the attack in advance, and permitted it to happen without alerting its commanding officers at Pearl Harbor or sending ships and planes to head off or at least challenge the Japanese ships and planes, unquote. Well, the part about breaking the Japanese code is true. The rest is a lie. More continuing. During the next 90 days, this letter was followed by a tidal wave of books, TV shows, cover stories in the weekly news magazines and Sunday papers, all commemorating in their own way what they believe happened at Pearl Harbor. The public, nearly two-thirds of whom were not alive when World War II started, was overwhelmed by a mass of contradictory stories. For example, the New York Times on November 30th, 1991 reported that, as of that date, there were 11 books, either new or newly reprinted, on sale, and all had conflicting views. Next, the Wall Street Journal of December 2nd summarized four major TV shows about the Japanese attack. Aside from the inaccurate conspiracy theories I mentioned earlier, the article pointed out that one of the shows dealt in, quote, crude revisionism, unquote, in which, quote, the Japanese are portrayed as victims, unquote. In another show, the narrator sought the easy way out. Rather than make a sound conclusion based on fact, he said only that it might, quote, be easier to search for conspiracies than to accept the fact that no one was to blame, unquote. Well, people were to blame, as we're going to see, and not Franklin Roosevelt. Meanwhile, the question of who was to blame for Pearl Harbor was being addressed by the Washington Post. On December 1st, 1991, it reported at length on the efforts of the family of the late Admiral Husband E. Kimmel, K-I-M-M-E-L, the commander-in-chief of the U.S. and Pacific fleets at Pearl Harbor, to rescue his name from the dustbin of history following his relief from command only 9 days after the Japanese attack. The Army commander at Hawaii, Lieutenant General Walter C. Short, was also relieved of command a few weeks after the attack. But for the Kimmel family and certain elements of the Navy, the relief of Kimmel is still a highly emotional issue. According to the Post, the controversy has been fanned recently by the following events. In October of 1990, the officers and trustees of the U.S. Naval Academy Alumni Association of Annapolis unanimously adopted a resolution calling for the Navy to restore Kimmel posthumously to the four-star rank he held before the Japanese attack. He lost this rank when he was relieved of command. In December of 1990, the Pearl Harbor Survivors Association adopted a resolution restoring the full wartime rank of both Admiral Kimmel and General Short. In October of 1991, according to the Post, quote, 36 retired flag rank officers, all but a few of them four-star admirals, wrote to President Bush, urging him, that's George H.W. Bush, the man for whom CIA headquarters is named, wrote to President Bush, urging him to take remedial action on his own authority. It should be pointed out that this so-called remedial action, unquote, was asked only for Kimmel. But then the Post, in a somewhat unusually partisan statement, heartily endorsed the admiral's petition, saying, quote, no day could be more favorable for restoring him, Kimmel, to the formal and public respect of his country than December 7th, 1991. That, of course, is the 50th anniversary of the attack. Continuing. I believe it unfortunate that so many fatal historical errors are being propounded about why the Japanese attack succeeded in catching our military forces at Pearl Harbor by surprise. The spreading of false information cannot go unchallenged. The history of Pearl Harbor needs correcting. A final judgment must be made. And so, after 50 years of silence, but with official notice that my investigation into the causes of Pearl Harbor is now declassified, it is time for me to speak. My story is impartial. I represent neither the Army nor the Navy. I'm a civilian at heart, a lawyer, and a civil litigator. And by the way, he's also a Republican, by the way. But what gives me the authority to speak now is the fact that I was the independent prosecutor appointed by Secretary of War Henry L. Stimson to investigate the root causes of Pearl Harbor after it had been determined that the reports of the Army Pearl Harbor Board were inaccurate because they were based on painted or perjured testimony. My report to Secretary Stimson was released as Volume 35 of the Pearl Harbor hearings. However, my report had no conclusion because when I turned it in, my work was considered top secret and I was not empowered as the independent prosecutor to speak for the Secretary of War and show how the Navy was as guilty as the Army for what happened at Pearl Harbor. I would add they were even more guilty, in my opinion. Thus, I could not say then what I believed about the failure of leadership by our president that contributed to the disaster. It is important to remember that my involvement in the subject of Pearl Harbor came after it was determined that the two reports of the Army Pearl Harbor Board were fatally flawed because the board made its two reports based on perjured and incomplete testimony. Too many historians have based their writings on the board's incorrect reports because they have wished to bolster their own views of what went wrong at Pearl Harbor. Thus, the various conspiracy theories of what went wrong at Pearl Harbor have gotten the upper hand in the debate, which is bad for history, bad for the public, and bad for the military. I have read all the books published to date, and this is, by the way, 1992, 1993, I have read all the books published to date on the subject of Pearl Harbor. These include the works of such notable authors as Walter Lord, John Poland, Gordon W. Prang, P-R-A-N-G-E, and the late Rear Admiral Ewing, Edwing, E-B-W-I-N-G-P, late male A-Y-P-O-N. All their books were bestsellers, yet all of them contain errors or omissions or improper theories or, in one book, outright lies. I do not wish to denigrate these authors, but the truth is that none of them have access to the files that I have access to, which included top-secret material that was unavailable to many of those in the high commands of either the Army or the Navy. Nor did they have access to the range of people with whom I dealt in both services on a formal and informal basis. And none of them had the extraordinary power that I possessed to make people tell me their stories under oath. Now, one of the things, again, Major Clausen, a Republican, by the way, not incidentally, he was commissioned by, again, Secretary of War Henry Stimson to look into the attack on Pearl Harbor. And as such, he was in possession of top-secret material, and in that regard, he carried around throughout the course of his investigation a pouch that was equipped with explosives, and if at any point in time he, incendiary explosives, he was in danger, or if there was any point at which people could snatch the documents, he was basically going to become a human bomb. He was going to be sacrificed. Again, that was how sensitive his inquiry was. And talking about that, we read, "There was one possibility I have overlooked, however, and it was corrected one afternoon when I met with Bundy." By the way, that was the father of the Bundys, who later were part of the Kennedy administration and were less than vigorous in their investigation. I believe they were directly involved in the conspiracy to murder JFK. "But there was one possibility I have overlooked, however, and it was corrected one afternoon when I met with Bundy. He called me into his office and without much preamble said, quote, 'Secretary Stimson is greatly concerned about the decrypts you are going to carry with you on your mission. He wants to make sure they are secure at all times. So we're going to use a method that involves strapping a special envelope to your pet chest. The envelope will hold the decrypts. Also a magnesium bomb. You'll have a cord that detonates the bomb when you pull it. If you are about to be captured, assuming you can't detonate the bomb at a distance, you will pull the cord and detonate the bomb closer. In any event, the bomb will burn the decrypts, that's decrypted messages, to a crisp." Unquote. Having just been told, admittedly in a very urbane way, how I was supposed to kill myself to avoid capture, I found myself speaking with some consternation. Quote, "Can I really detonate the bomb at a distance?" Unquote, I asked. Again, quoting, "If not, unquote, I suppose I will be crisp. If not, I suppose I will be crisp just like the decrypts as they waltz their way to heaven. I am not resisting your idea. I hope you understand. It's just that I fear some silly pilot might make me parachute into a jungle," unquote. "I'm sorry, Henry," unquote, said Bundy, again quoting, "There is no alternative. We have been ordered by Congress to conduct this investigation, and we will have guards for you at all the appropriate places. But if the enemy captured these decrypts, It will expose our greatest secret, so I must ask that you be prepared to take this extreme action. I paused for a moment to think it through. Quote, okay, I understand all this and I accept the order, unquote, I said, again quoting, I would become a walking bomb. When do I get this apparatus, unquote? I have it here, unquote, Bundy said. My heart sank as he showed me the contrivance. Quote, does it have a safety, unquote? Again, quoting from Mr. Bundy. Yes, it's built so you can keep it on safety, but when you're in a war zone, the bomb must always be armed and the safety turned off, unquote. In the months that followed, I was very unhappy to entrust my life to an unthinking device that, if it malfunctioned, would incinerate me in a flash. Strapped over my solar plexus, the damned envelope was stiff and uncomfortable to wear. And whenever I met a friend in a war zone and he slapped me on the back in greeting, I winced inwardly, waiting for the worst to happen. So again, this is the degree of that. This was during the war. This was in 1944. The war was still on. More about the security arrangements surrounding Major Clausen and his inquiry. Again, quoting from Pearl Harbor Final Judgment. Mine wasn't an ordinary office. The outer door was made of steel and had a big combination lock for a doorknob. It looked like a bank vault. No one could enter without the permission of Colonel Hughes or myself, and access was so tightly restricted that only we had the combination for the door. Inside, there were no desks with drawers, only flat-top tables plus row upon row of armored file cabinets, each with its special combination lock containing all the records of the Army Pearl Harbor Board and related papers. And again, that was his office. So it is quite remarkable. Now, we've been talking about the Army Board, about that board and its composition. And Major Clausen writes about this as follows, and we read, meanwhile, by joint resolution on June 13, 1944, Congress directed that the Secretaries of War and the Navy were to investigate Pearl Harbor and court-martial any personnel found guilty of dereliction of duty, crime, or offense against the United States. The resolution had been sparked by Senator Ferguson, more about him later, who had testified in a perfect manner for me as a prosecution. One more time. The resolution had been sparked by Senator Ferguson, that's Senator Homer Ferguson, more about him later, who had testified in a perfect manner for me as a prosecution witness in the Laughlin case. Having been involved in the Laughlin case, I understood the collective shudder that went through the War and Navy departments when this joint resolution was passed. It did not take long for the people who supported General Short and Admiral Kimmel to start beating the drums on their behalf. Issues of fact became subordinate to political considerations. So did the issue of national security. From a list of names sent forward by Chief of Staff Marshall, Secretary Stinson appointed the famous or infamous Pearl Harbor Board. It consisted of three general officers whom Marshall had relieved of command at one time or another. One more time. It consisted of three general officers whom Marshall, again the Chief of Staff, had relieved of command at one time or another. I considered this to be a fatal mistake by Marshall at the outset. The three were Lieutenant General George Grunert, G-R-U-N-E-R-P, Major General Walter H. Frank, F-R-A-N-K, and Major General Henry B. Russell, R-U-S-S-E-L-L. And again, that is quite remarkable. And not surprisingly, they found that, blame didn't lie with the people in the military. By the way, one of the things we really don't have time to go into, I'll encapsulate it here. There were plenty of F-ups in connection with the attack on Pearl Harbor. Inter-service rivalry figured here in a big way between the Army and the Navy. The magic intercepts, not only the intercepts from the Purple Code, about which we will speak at length, but also the British intercepts of the German Enigma Code that was broken by the Ultra people at Bletchley Park. More about that later. They were combined into a top-secret code amalgam, we could say, called the Magic Intercepts. and they were being provided to the military commanders at Pearl Harbor. But one day it was the Army, the next day it was the Navy, the next day the Army, the next day the Navy. That didn't help a thing. There were also fierce inter-service rivalries. To this day, there are inter-service rivalries. Navy officers drink Cubby Song. Even the Scots, they drink Navy officers drink Cubby. Army officers drink Johnny Walker. But now, back to the Pearl Harbor. So again, there were plenty of F-ups in connection with the attack on Pearl Harbor, but there was also, you know, there was more than that, as we'll see. Getting back to the Army, both again, three people who were relieved of command by General Chief of Staff George Marshall, and surprisingly, they found that he was culpable. Can't believe that happened. I mean, I'm being sarcastic, obviously. Returning to Pearl Harbor final judgment. The problem with the board's report, in reality, there were two reports, one secret and one top secret, the latter dealing with the issue of breaking of the Japanese, of the breaking of the Japanese codes, were myriad. The board members had reached mistaken assumptions about when the Japanese had actually set sail on their way to attack. They preferred to believe that the Japanese had dispatched their attacking force toward Pearl Harbor as a result of Secretary of State Cordell Hull's proposals of November 26th, when in fact the Japanese fleet had gone to sea before that date. The report said that Hull had to bear some responsibility for Pearl Harbor because his message to Tokyo on November 26th, quote, was used by the Japanese as a signal to begin war by the attack on Pearl Harbor, unquote. There were also errors about spying in Hawaii and claims that the Japanese had their submarines inside Pearl Harbor before the attack. The board found that the Army commander on the spot, Lieutenant General Walter C. Short, had failed to alert his command adequately for war, but then the board had gone on to fault the War Department for not ordering Short to prepare, quote, an inadequate alert, unquote, and for not keeping Short properly informed about the ongoing diplomatic negotiations between Japan and America. The board had also been extremely critical of the actions of Chief of Staff Marshall. He was accused of failing to keep his immediate staff properly informed about developments, of failing to brief General Short adequately, and of failing to send Short, quote, important information, unquote, on December 6th and 7th that would have warned Short that an attack was coming. Lastly, the board said that Marshall was responsible for not knowing that Short's command was not prepared for war. In brief, the Army board was saying that, like Short, Marshall should be relieved of command. And again, three of the principal officers appointed to that board had been relieved of command at one point, another by General Marshall. So, surprise, surprise. Now, about Senator Homer Ferguson, we're going to talk more about him later. He was a barn-burning Republican, and he was one of the people who was pointing an accusing finger at Franklin Roosevelt. Henry Clausen writes about Senator Homer Ferguson as follows. The statements by the Army and the Navy failed to satisfy a lot of people, most notably Senator Homer Ferguson, a Republican from Michigan about whom I will say a lot later. He was a staunch supporter of Admiral Kimmel, and a believer that the Roosevelt administration had forced the Japanese to attack Pearl Harbor to achieve Roosevelt's ambition to fight the Axis. The Army Board report would have made him very happy. Ferguson couldn't figure out how we had lost all those battleships and sailors at Pearl Harbor without somebody's having done something that was worthy of court-martial. They did. More about that later, and that's Kimmel and to a lesser extent, I think, Short, but certainly Kimmel. By the way, the military forces in the Pacific and Hawaii in particular were under the command of the Navy at that point in time. General Short was in charge of the Army forces, but it was the responsibility of the Navy to inform him, and they did inform him. Admiral Kimmel did inform him, as we'll see. But again, like Admiral Kimmel, he basically effed the duck and then didn't want to clean up the tail feathers afterward. Continuing, I'm repeating the last sentence. Ferguson couldn't figure out how we had lost all those battleships and sailors at Pearl Harbor without somebody's having done something that was worthy of court-martial. Why hadn't heads rolled either in the military or in the administration? He believed there must be a cover-up going on to protect people in high places. Roosevelt, Hull, and Marshall, for starters. Hull, by the way, is then Secretary of State. Cordell Hull. Now, more about the shifting of blame to Franklin Roosevelt. And this goes right to the very core of what is going on today. The Republican nominee for president in 1944 who was defeated by Franklin Roosevelt was Thomas Dewey. He also ran in 1948, and his campaign manager, his official title was speechwriter, was Alan Dulles, who was in charge of secret intelligence for the OSS in World War II in Bern, later a key member of the Warren Commission as well. But Dewey was aware that the U.S. had broken the Japanese Purple Code. By the way, there are a number of codes that were relevant here. There was the Low Security Winds Code. There was a Winds Code of the Low Security J-19 system, also to be used via radio. Then the most important here is the Purple Code. That was a diplomatic code that had been broken, and that will figure in a prominent way, a central way, in our discussion. It was also the White Code. That was a military code that was broken later during the war, but had not been broken at this point in time. But the Purple Code had been. And Thomas Dewey was apprised of the fact that we had broken the code, but because this was wartime, he was advised not to make that public. But he knew about it, and he was planning as having a major element of his campaign to be that Franklin Roosevelt was culpable for the attack on Pearl Harbor. And Clausen writes as follows. In those days, only a tiny number of people knew about our having broken the Japanese codes before Pearl Harbor. Nor did the public know that General Clark, as commander of the Army's communications intelligence operations, had been the courier between the Army's chief of staff, George C. Marshall, and the Republican presidential candidate Thomas E. Dewey in the election of 1944. Somehow, I am not sure how exactly, Dewey had learned that the United States had broken the Japanese codes before Pearl Harbor. His campaign strategy was obvious, to charge that the administration of President Franklin D. Roosevelt had been aware of the Japanese intentions to attack Pearl Harbor, but had done nothing to prevent it. One more time. His campaign strategy was obvious, to charge the administration of President Franklin D. Roosevelt had been aware of the Japanese intentions to attack Pearl Harbor, but had done nothing to prevent it. In turn, this brought America into the war against the Axis powers, which Roosevelt had wanted and the Republicans had been trying to prevent. Needless to say, if Dewey followed this strategy, he would probably win the election. Now, according to Clausen, he did not mention that during the campaign, but it then became one of the core elements of the conspiracy theory that followed in this general discussion. Now, getting to substance, the U.S. military command at Pearl Harbor, not only Admiral Husband Kimmel, about whom we'll say a great deal, but also General Walter Short, they were apprised of what was going to take place. Now, Major Clausen writes as follows. The primary duty of Short and Kimmel was to protect the fleet. This was made clear by the Secretary of the Navy, Frank Knox, who wrote a letter to his counterpart, the Secretary of War, Henry Stimson, on January 24th, 1941. One more time. This was made clear by the Secretary of the Navy, Frank Knox, who wrote a letter to his counterpart, the Secretary of War, Henry Stimson, on January 24, 1941, which said, quote, if war eventuates with Japan, it is believed easily possible that hostilities would be initiated by a surprise attack on the fleet or the naval base at Pearl Harbor. The dangers envisioned in short of their, one more time, if war eventuates with Japan, it is believed easily possible that hostilities would be initiated by a surprise attack upon the fleet or the naval base at Pearl Harbor. The dangers envisaged, in order of their importance and probability, are considered to be 1, air bombing attack, 2, air torpedo plane attack, 3, sabotage, 4, submarine attack. They all took place except for sabotage. Again, this was January 24th, 1941. One more time. The primary duty of Short and Kimmel was to protect the fleet. This was made clear by the Secretary of the Navy, Frank Knox, who will deliver to his counterpart, the Secretary of War, Henry Stimson, on January 24, 1941, which said, quote, "If war eventuates with Japan, it is believed easily possible that hostilities would be initiated by a surprise attack upon the fleet or the naval base at Pearl Harbor. The dangers envisaged in order of their importance and probability are considered to be 1. Air bombing attack, that took place. 2. Air torpedo plane attack, that took place. 3. Sabotage, that did not. 4. Submarine attack, that did take place, and we will talk more about that later. This was January 24th, 1941. I will also note in passing that it was in January of 1941 that the U.S. began developing a naval base on Wake Island in the Pacific. Now, the USS Enterprise, one of the carriers in the Pacific, had been ferrying aircraft to Wake Island pursuant to the notice I'm about to read, and it was on its way back to Pearl Harbor. It was supposed to have arrived on December 6th, but it ran into a storm. It arrived off of Pearl Harbor on December 7th, and some of its aircraft were actually shot down, some by the Japanese, some by friendly fire, when they were on their way into Pearl Harbor to deal with things there. But that's why the Enterprise, and no Star Trek jokes, please, that's why the USS Enterprise was not at Pearl Harbor, because it was ferrying aircraft to Wake Island and was on its way back. And the USS Lexington was not in Pearl Harbor because it was ferrying aircraft to Midway Island. And the aircraft in question did not have sufficient range to fly there on their own. The other aircraft carrier was the USS Saratoga, and that was in basically for routine servicing in San Diego. That is why the carriers were not present, not because, you know, Franklin Roosevelt did this, Franklin Roosevelt did that. I mean, it's just it's infuriating, but it has passed into internet wisdom, shall we say. Now, very, very important is the following. This is really, really important, and everything that we are going to discuss should be seen in light of this. And again, bear in mind the position that Major Clausen was in. He had all of the decrypts strapped to his chest with a magnesium bomb. And he writes as follows. The facts of the situation were these. On November 27th, 1941, one more time, the facts of the situation were these. On November 27, 1941, both the Navy and the Army sent special warnings of war to their respective commanders at Pearl Harbor. The dispatch sent by the Chief of Naval Operations to Kimmel, that's Admiral Husband Kimmel, began with the fateful words, quote, "This dispatch is to be considered a war warning," unquote. The message also instructed Kimmel to inform Short of the warning, and Short acknowledged after the Japanese attack that he had in fact seen that message. On the same day, a dispatch over General Marshall's signature went to Short that read, quote, "Negotiations with Japan appear to be terminated to all practical purposes, with only the barest possibilities that the Japanese government might come back and offer to continue. Japanese future action unpredictable, but hostile action possible at any moment." Again, this is November 27th, 1941, 10 days before the attack. "If hostilities cannot be avoided, the United States desires that Japan commit the first overt act. This policy should not be construed as restricting you to a course of action that might jeopardize your defense. Prior to hostile Japanese action, you are directed to undertake such reconnaissance and other measures as you deem necessary. But these measures should be carried out so as not to alarm civilian population or disclose intent. Report measures taken. Should hostilities occur, you will carry out the tasks assigned to a rainbow Should hostilities occur, you will carry out the task assigned in Rainbow 5 so far as they pertain to Japan. Limit dissemination of this highly secret information to minimum essential officers." Emphasis added. Rainbow Five, by the way, was the U.S. plan to mobilize for the Second World War. It was leaked to the press by Admiral Albert Kobe Wiedemeyer, who later replaced General Stilwell as the military advisor to Chiang Kai-shek. And Wiedemeyer, by the way, had part of his military education at the German Kriegswehr Academy, and that was the German equivalent of West Point. He rented his apartment in Germany from Gerhard Rosbach, who was Ernst Röhm's number two man in command of the Nazi Brownshirts. And Rosbach, by the way, like so many good Nazis, went to work for, in the post-war period, drumroll fanfare, the CIA. I'm going to repeat this last passage again, because it's really important. This is November 27th, 1941. By the way, one of the things that has entered into the BS here, it would not have, assuming, you know, the conspiracy theories, et cetera, et cetera, it would not have been necessary to have the attack be as devastating as it was in order to provoke the American people to war, assuming that it was a provocation, which it was not. If the defenses at Pearl Harbor had been alerted in time, which they should have been, and if aircraft had been scrambled, and the anti-aircraft weaponry was crewed, basically if general quarters had been sounded, the Japanese attack would not have been nearly as devastating as it was, but it still would have mobilized the American people. But again, the facts of Henry Claus, repeating what we've just gone into, the facts of the situation were these. On November 27th, 1941, both the Navy and the Army sent special warnings of war to their respective commanders at Pearl Harbor. The dispatch sent by the Chief of Naval Operations to Kimmel began with the fateful words, quote, "This dispatch is to be considered a war warning," unquote. By the way, the next day was the day that the Enterprise headed out to Wake Island, which, beginning in January of 1941, was being developed as a U.S. military base. Eventually, it was conquered by the Japanese. It ultimately was only turned over to the U.S. on September 4th of 1945, after the surrender at Pearl Harbor. Continuing. The facts of the situation were these. On November 27, 1941, both the Navy and the Army sent special warnings of war to their respective commanders at Pearl Harbor. The dispatch sent by the Chief of Naval Operations to Kimmel began with the fateful words, quote, "This dispatch is to be considered a war warning," unquote. The message also instructed Kimmel to inform Short of the warning, and Short acknowledged after the Japanese attack that he had in fact seen that message. On the same day, a dispatch over General Marshall's signature went to Short that read, quote, "Negotiations with Japan appear to be terminated to all practical purposes, with only the barest possibilities that the Japanese government might come back and offer to continue. Japanese future action unpredictable, but hostile action possible at any moment. If hostilities cannot be avoided, the United States desires that Japan commit the first overt act. This policy should not, repeat, not be construed as restricting you to a course of action that might jeopardize your defense." Omotan. "This policy should not, repeat, not be construed as restricting you to a course of action that might jeopardize your defense. Prior to hostile Japanese action, you are directed to undertake such reconnaissance and other measures as you deem necessary, but these measures should be carried out so as not, repeat, not to alarm civilian population or disclose intent." We'll talk about what the newspapers in Hawaii were talking about. They knew about this. Continuing, "Report measures taken. Should hostilities occur, you will carry out the tasks assigned in Rainbow Five so far as they pertain to Japan. Limit dissemination of this highly secret information to minimum essential officers." Emphasis added. By the way, Albert Wiedemeyer leaked the information about Rainbow Five to the press on December 5th of 1941. And we're going to repeat something in our next show, but this is really important. Now, bear in mind that the Japanese purple code, a diplomatic code, had in fact been broken. We're going to go into this. I'm going to repeat this in our next program. This is really important. The third message was sent in the purple code from Tokyo to Washington on December 1st, but was not translated in Washington until December 5th. This message told Washington to, quote, This continued the use of the, by the way, Washington, this is the Japanese embassy in Washington. And all of the references here are to the Japanese embassy. The third message was sent in the purple code from Tokyo to Washington on December 1st, but was not translated in Washington until December 5th. This message told Washington to, quote, discontinue the use of your code machine, purple, and dispose of it immediately, unquote. Special emphasis was given to taking the machine apart and breaking up its important parts. Washington was also ordered to burn its machine purple codes. The fourth message advised the diplomats that if they had to destroy their codes, they should contact the naval attaché in that particular embassy and use the special chemicals the attaché possessed to ensure that vital documents and equipment were properly destroyed. This message was sent by Tokyo on December 1st in the purple code and was translated in Washington on the same day, December 1st. 1941. The fifth message was also sent in the purple code from Tokyo to Washington on December 2nd. Translated on December 3rd, corrected on December 4th, it gave specific instructions to the Japanese diplomats in Washington to burn all their purple codes plus all the other codes the embassy possessed. Only one copy each of two special codes were to be retained for future use. Washington also was told that it was to, quote, stop using at once one purple code machine unit and destroy it completely, unquote, again, that's the Japanese embassy. Meanwhile, a cipher specialist named Kosaka, K-O-S-A-K-A, should have been returned to Tokyo on a Japanese ship that left the U.S. on November 28th. These last three messages were of extreme significance. When a nation prepares to launch an attack and go to war, one of the most indispensable steps it can take is to make sure that its codes and code machines cannot be captured by the enemy should the enemy retaliate and raid an embassy for intelligence reasons. Washington knew from reading these messages that war would have to break out with Japan attacking somewhere in the Pacific. Therefore, the Navy in Washington alerted Kimmel on December 3rd by sending two advisory messages that paraphrased the intercepts I have described above. The first message read as follows. Highly reliable information has been received that categoric and urgent instructions were sent yesterday to Japanese diplomatic and consular posts at Hong Kong, Singapore, Batavia, Manila, and Washington and London to destroy most of their codes and ciphers at once, and to burn all other important confidential and secret documents. The second message to Admiral Kimmel read, Circular 2444 from Tokyo, 1 December, ordered London, Hong Kong, Singapore, and Manila to destroy machine, Batavia machine already sent Tokyo. December 2nd, Washington also directed destroyed all but one copy of other systems and all secret documents. British Admiralty London today reports Embassy London has completed. Again, this is the Japanese embassies. Clausen goes on to write, because the Navy paraphrased these warning messages to Kimmel, they differ somewhat from the messages that I carried in my bomb pouch, which I showed to Admiral Rochefort. Both the Navy warning messages to Kimmel are exceedingly important, but the second is the more important. The first implies that Tokyo has ordered its embassies and consulates around the world to burn their codes. But it is the second that says, without equivocation, that Tokyo has ordered its consulates to destroy their codes and code machines. Once code machines were destroyed, there could be no turning back potential Japanese attacks. The consulates could no longer communicate effectively with Tokyo. War had to follow. It was inevitable. This meant that Rochefort had seen vital intelligence warnings to Kimmel, indicating that Japan was preparing to attack within a matter of days or hours. And again, this was communicated to Admiral Kimmel before the attack on Pearl Harbor. However, this concludes For the Record program number 1362, What Really Happened at Pearl Harbor Part 1. This is being recorded on December 7th of 2024. I'm Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.